Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're happy to be joined by Dan Tudor. Dan is the founder and owner of Tudor Collegiate Strategies, and he's the host of the great podcast called College Recruiting Weekly. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks, guys. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Before we dive in, I'm curious, what drew you to the world of college recruiting?
Well, at the risk of taking up your entire podcast with the backstory of how this got here, I'll try to summarize it quickly. I was an athlete in high school, could have played college tennis, but just that was just not my priority. I had it in my head to be a TV sportscaster, and so I went to actually school out in California, Cal State University, Bakersfield, and I started studying communications, got an internship, and then a job at the local ABC station, and I did that for 7 years. So I actually got to do what I went to college for, realized that I didn't like staying up till midnight every single night. It's great when you're out of college. It's a little bit different when you get married and you start wanting to have a family and realize that I don't want to be working at a TV station until 1 a.m. every day. So, and through that whole process, I'd always maintained some ties in coaching football and I will say studying recruiting. Just I thought it was interesting how some kids get recruited and then sequel and this whole process was fascinating to me, and started just understanding how were kids getting out and getting seen along the way. So I was doing that on the side, coaching on the side, left television, got into sales and marketing with a fairly large national company, and started, I became a manager there, a trainer, regional director, and But the whole recruiting thing fascinated me. And so after another 6 or 7 years of doing that, I started a recruiting service. Now, this was back in the early 90s, mid-90s. So the internet really wasn't a thing yet. And it was sort of an old-style recruiting service where we would send reports and profiles out to colleges of kids that we were trying to help get recruited. And it worked. They got recruited. And everything was going great. And along the way, what I discovered was that most college coaches were really having trouble communicating to their recruits, because we would get parents that would ask us, hey, I think I got this letter or I got this message from a coach. I think they're interested, but I don't really know. As he said this, but it was just, they were confused. They didn't know what to do. And I would read some of these things, and I just thought, oh my gosh, this is really a badly, bad attempt at communicating with somebody who doesn't know what to do in the process. And it hit me. Well, I mean, they've never been trained like I have, both on the communication side, but then also on the sales and marketing side. Because when you're with a large national company, they don't just let you go out and make a fool of yourself. There's months and months and months of training. Well, coaches don't get that. And so I sort of filed that idea away. Eventually that company sold, and I started communicating with college athletic directors that I had contact with and coaches. And it really started out as the newsletter that goes out that a lot of coaches read every Tuesday.
Yep, I get it.
Started that in 2005, and I really, honestly, guys, I didn't even know if it was a business. I just knew that coaches needed the help, and so I just sort of started giving advice away for free, and then I wrote a couple of guides and books. I thought, well, this is good. We'll offer that, and that'll be some revenue associated with doing the business. And then people started asking if we did workshops, and we started doing workshops, and then they started saying, hey, I get what you're saying in the workshops, but I don't have time for it. Can you do it for us? And so we started doing that, where we developed their strategy and did a lot of research. And it just got deeper and more involved, and I would say better in the sense that we can apply now so much research to the whole thing that, I mean, at the base level, if a coach follows our instructions, they're going to improve. They're going to get more response because we're hitting all these psychological buttons now that we know exist among college athletes or wannabe college athletes and their parents. And it just has grown into kind of, I like to think of us as that we help college coaches be better at what they already do. So we don't ask coaches to change anything. We're not trying to make them all robots. We want them to exert their personality and show, you know, the things that they want to show and talk about the things that they want to talk about. But we just want to add a level or a measure of consistency and strategy and help them understand kind of what's going on behind the scenes and what college prospects are really thinking and how they're going through that whole decision-making process. So that's what now we do all over the country and have been now for moving up into 15 years.
That's awesome. I guess to start, Dan, what are some things you recommend for a first-time head coach or a recruiting coordinator when designing their recruiting plan?
Oh, wow. You may have to stop me after half an hour because that's a big question. But if I was to say, here's the starting point for me would be establish what it is that you want. And here's what I mean by that, that you have to decide, who am I going to go after? You know, that can be location, that can be quality, that can be, you know, how many. There has to be some sort of end goal for a coach. And that sounds so simple, but you would be surprised the number of coaches that don't really go into any year with a plan. Their plan is, I need to recruit a lot of kids, so I'm going to go out and look and get as many on my list as possible and then try to get their interest. And that is a very, very difficult way to go about recruiting because there is no strategy aligned to it. It would almost be, you know, if a volleyball coach or a basketball coach or a baseball coach held a couple of practices and then they had a game and said, okay, you know, guys, go out there and do your best. Try to win. No strategy, no game plan. There was no, you know, film breakdown. And that's what a lot of coaches end up doing in recruiting is, I have this list and I'm going to try to write this stuff and send it out and hopefully something sticks and I get a response. So I would say first and foremost, a coach has to understand what they want and how many, you know, A caliber guys or kids can I get, and what do my B's look like, what do my C's look like, and start with that plan. And then the next thing is, there has to be internal organization behind any kind of recruiting plan that takes place. What that means is that I feel like any staff should have one core recruiting coordinator. Now, some smaller staffs, that might be the head coach. You're the head coach and the recruiting coordinator. But there should be one person in charge of making sure that information is going out on a regular basis and that there is some sort of plan for review you start with this big number. Your goal as a recruiter is not to maintain that big number. Your goal as a recruiter is to, as quickly as possible, whittle that down to the smallest possible group that is interested. Because if you don't, then you're 4 or 5, 8 months later and you've still got this group that may or may not be interested. That gets difficult. So there's a limit to what a coach can do. And I think where recruiting starts to get overwhelming for a coaching staff or an individual coach is when they start off and all they have is names. All they have are, you know, they need these positions and they're just talking and they're just giving out information, and it's not enough for these kids. It's not enough for families. Very few good athletes will come to a place just because you're outlining the degrees that you have and how big your campus is and the recent history of the program. That's not how this generation of athlete makes their decision. So there has to be some sort of organization that says, I'm going to start here, but then very quickly I'm going to figure out who's interested and I'm going to take that group and work on them, but then I may need to start a second group and add. And that's how you get, I think, the numbers and the quality. So, I mean, as far as the first two things, that would be where I would start.
Dan, you were talking about how a lot of coaches go at it the wrong way, spewing off information and facts about their campus and their school and degrees offered and yada, yada. What other misconceptions do you see that are pretty common from coaches who you're working with?
Well, just on the communication side, and this may not be in any particular order, but one of the first things we see is a coach, and I don't know how this got started, has come to believe that social media is the way that you're supposed to recruit. Social media is in text messaging. That is what kids want, and that's how best to recruit. I will say that competitively, I like it when we hear coaches that we're competing with take that philosophy, because they're going to lose almost every time. And again, I'm a competitive guy, and so if we're working with a client, I want to win. They're on social media a lot. They're on it because it's fun. They're on it because that's where their friends are. They like to, in some cases, get news or pictures. They go there to be entertained. What they're not there to receive is a sales message. Same thing through text messaging. We don't like getting sales messages on our text message. I get upset when you get the little AT&T warning that we've approached 75% of our data for the month, and we're going to get charged another $15. Even that bugs me. Like, it just invades that little private that private domain where we're supposed to be able to go back and forth and talk with our friends and our family and everything. So coaches who try to do only that, or they're trying to communicate via social media, or they think that putting inspirational quotes and pictures and cool graphics on social media is what gets kids to come to their program. I think it's not so much now, a misconception, because they've learned their lesson. They don't get those recruits. That's an element of it. That's the personal side of it. But you have to insert the logic. And the best way that we have found to recruit a student athlete, and this is from the student athletes telling us, here's what they want and here's how we want to be recruited, coach. They love letters. They value written mail because it's proof. It's paper. The point that I make all the time to coaches is that to prove how valuable that is, every coach probably still has their letters that they received in college, stuffed away somewhere or at their parents' house, or you know, throw them away. Why? Because it's proof that you were a good athlete and somebody thought you were good, and there's their signature and there's the school's logo, and there's just proof that you were good. And so these athletes are looking for the same thing. So they love written mail, and they'll read it and they'll share it. And believe it or not, the same thing with email. One of the biggest misconceptions that if you have somebody listening to this, that I would want them to get past is this idea that kids don't read their emails. Now, if it's a poorly written salesy email, they're not going to read it and they're not going to respond. If it's you personally telling them about something about your program they think that you want them to know about, a lot of times you'll have the contact management database. Then there's plenty of them out there, the popular ones that manage your contacts and help you track recruits. And are they, receiving your information and opening it? A lot of coaches they kind of scratch their head and say, wow, these kids, I see them opening an email 6 or 7 or 8 times, but they don't respond to me. Well, the reason they're opening it 6 or 7 or 8 times should be an indicator, first of all, that they read their email. It may not be every day or every hour like they're on social media, but they read their email and they tell us that that is one of the main ways they want coaches to communicate with them, because I can compartmentalize that. That's my recruiting area over there. I don't usually go and spend time on email, but it's something that's there when I want to interact with it. But they're trying to figure out how do I respond to this? So it's not the method necessarily, it's the language within that method. And if the language is important, and you need to just talk like you would talk in the way that I've just, kind of rambled on here. I've had run-on sentences, poor punctuation, but it sounds real. This is how we talk to each other. And for some reason, we as adults have learned mistakenly that when we're recruiting, we're supposed to make it this, you know, beautifully written Magna Carta document that's, you know, flowery and big words and perfectly structured. And when a kid reads it, they say, that's not a real person. That went to like 1,000 other kids. That's not just to me. So you can take the same message, and as long as it sounds personal, I think it counts. And if you do that in a letter or an email, guess what? You'll get a response. Kids will actually reply to your email. And so that is probably one of the biggest myths that, from a communication standpoint, that's out there. And I'll give you one more that on sort of on the back end behind the scenes that we find. A lot of coaches feel like, you know, I don't want to recruit the parents because then I've got to, you know, put up with them while they, you know, if their son or their daughter comes to our school, now we get the parents with us because we paid all this attention to them in the recruiting process. What I tell coaches is that if you are under the myth that an athlete doesn't rely or look at or listen to their parents during the recruiting process, they're nuts. They absolutely do. In fact, if you're not recruiting the parents, and the philosophy sometimes is, well, we're going to get to know the parents once they come onto campus. I got news for you, coaches, that they're not going to come to campus most of the time, if you aren't interacting with the parents, because who's setting up that visit? Mom and dad. Who's paying for a lot of it? Mom and dad. Who is giving them permission to go or to not go? Mom or dad. And so to ignore the parents in this, I think it just doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense to your kids. We get athletes all the time in the focus groups that we do that we'll talk about, we'll just talk about, you know, that, wow, I didn't take that school seriously because they didn't even talk to my dad. So they're actually, it's a little confusing to them why coaches don't do that. It's not, you know, not only do they want that interaction with the parent, they expect it. And when it doesn't happen, it feels odd to them. You know, again, you take a sport like volleyball, you think of all of the interaction they had with parents, you know, go back to the asking these questions, who paid for club? Mom and dad. Who arranged all the travel every weekend? Mom or dad. And who helped load the car, unload the car, go to the hotel? The parents are actively involved in every aspect of them becoming a good athlete in that sport. Why would college coaches ignore the parents and say, no, this is the time now where mom, dad, you have to sit over there, when they haven't had any kind of frame of reference for why that should happen? So those would probably be the two biggest myths, one on the communication side and just one procedurally that we see happening and coaches making that mistake pretty consistently.
That's awesome, Dan. That's probably crazy for a lot of people to hear that written letters are still really important to recruits.
Yeah. Well, can I go one step further with that, just as more proof as to why that is? I mean, all of you are coaches, and you know coaches who are recruits, and you have athletes that are younger. When you send a letter, understand that as a coach, that might be the first time that that athlete has ever received a letter in their life addressed to them. First time. Hmm. Personal. So that's huge. There's an excitement. You notice, and you probably, you know, get stories every once in a while from kids that get real possessive of their mail. They don't throw it away, just like you didn't throw yours away. They really like the mail. Why? Because it's proof. It's tangible. I can, you know, if it's a piece of paper, I can feel it, and there's the logo, and there's your signature, and they don't throw it away. And the other thing that I point out to coaches is why it's so impressive to kids when you send them a letter and why they revere it so much is because they have no idea how to do it. They have no idea how to send a letter. Ask any of your guys, any of your players to go and mail a letter. They won't know what to do. The vast majority of them have no idea what to do, where to get a stamp, much less if I manage to get a stamp, where do I put the stupid letter once I have it? And so you've managed to crack this magical communication system that they have no idea how to do. And so there's a little bit of mystery to it.
Mm-hmm. So if we can do carrier pigeon, that's even better.
Oh, carrier pigeon would be huge, or some sort of like a speedy delivery, you know, personal messenger. That'd be awesome. That's probably not allowed by the NCAA, the messenger part.
So Dan, you've done a lot of deep dives with focus groups, with research.
what has come out of those that's been really surprising? Maybe something that just totally knocked you off your chair and you said, oh my gosh, that is not at all what I thought this was going to be.
I don't know if there's been something that was just completely out of left field that we just didn't expect. I think to the level that something was confirmed, there's the perception that, you know, just like, let's say, male-female athletes in high school. You take a women's sport, you know, again, let's just say it's a volleyball, women's volleyball player and a men's volleyball player. And, well, they're so different and they're, you know, they're completely, you know, they'll make their decisions completely separately. No, they actually don't. I could show you results of, you know, a question about what influences them to make their final decision and, you know, having to rank things in a priority fashion. And if I mix stuff up, not just with volleyball, but for all sports at all division levels, you wouldn't be able to tell which one is the male athlete, which one's the female athlete. So one of the more interesting stats that we have found, is, and it's been confirmed over the last 3 years because we keep studying it and measuring it, is the connection with the team. Like as far as deciding which place, which program is best for me, how important, you know, what are the factors? What are the big factors driving you as an athlete deciding which place is best? And how the players treated me when I was on my visit it's always number one. I should say always. Once in a while, it slips to number two behind how the coaches treated me on my visit. But usually, it's the athletes, and that's what they're looking for: is how do I get along with the team? And what was surprising is that when you ask that question, a higher percentage of male athletes say it's more important to them than the female athletes. So it ranks even higher. And how I explain that after listening to kids explain it to us is, I think female athletes a little more mature, like in a club setting. I've got these two friends. We're really close. I don't really like those two girls over there, but we can play and, you know, we'll come together as a team and I'm okay. They're just more mature about the whole relationship with their friends. With guys, if I go as an athlete and I walk into, dinner with the team or the locker room or after practice, and I get the sense that those guys don't want me there or they don't like me, I'm not going to that school. That will not be something that I'm going to be good with. And I've never had an athlete that has said, you know what, I didn't like the coach, didn't feel like he wanted me, and I really didn't get along with the guys on the team. But boy, what a facility! And so I came there. Never heard that. I've heard the other way. I've heard that. The facility is not that great and their record, they're still building, but love the guys, love the coach. So that's where I'm going. So that emotional sway, that's what they're looking for. And I wish more coaches would recruit to that and focus on the relationship instead of just kind of mindlessly reciting the stats and the bullet points of what their school has, which, spoiler alert, every school has most of what every other school has. That's, you all have degrees. Everybody has an up-and-coming program or, a family feel, beautiful campus. All those things are common. And so it always is this five-way or four-way tie for first place. And what breaks the tie? It's the emotional side. And very few coaches have mastered how to communicate that and how to, once they're on campus, how to really accentuate it so that they're the obvious choice in the end.
I like hearing this because Andrew is at Stanford and he does have a couple things going there, but hopefully I can beat him out with the tips you're giving me. So I know you've been around a lot of great recruiters and you've spent time working with them and observing them. So I'm wondering what some of the skills you've noticed that they have that they've developed.
Oh, that's a good question. Okay. So from as far as common traits, here's something interesting that we go through. Like when we lead a workshop on a campus, or with an individual program, sometimes we'll get into this concept of, everybody, if you just from a visual standpoint, since people are listening to this, if you kind of created three categories of A players, B players, and C players, so everyone's, from a ranking or talent level, A's, B's, and C's. In your program, it could be 1s, 2s, or 3s, or, you know, 4 stars, 5 stars, whatever. But let's just say A's, B's, and C's. Everybody wants the A player. It's a smaller group, so that A player group is elite. And especially if you're talking about a school like Stanford or any other BCS school, I mean, they're competing for the same 30 or 40 players around the country that are going to be those next level game-changing players. And that number might be smaller in certain years. So the so everyone wants the A's. And so what usually happens is staff say, let's go get the A's. Come on, let's press. Let's go hard. Let's go hard. Let's go hard. And if it doesn't work out, then we'll get the B's. And hopefully we'll get enough of those so we don't have to get the C's. And that's how it's always been for 20 years. And there's these programs out there that, as we've studied them, and as you noted, we get to be inside, inside the program with these great coaches at all different levels. So last year we worked with, from our client list, we had 7 national champions in different sports and different division levels around the country. And, you know, if I take them and then past programs where we've had just really good coaches where they just sort of perennially build these juggernauts, we see that they do it a little bit differently. What they'll do is they'll figure out, you know what, every year I get, in any class I get about, let's say, that class I'll get 20 or 25% that are A's. I'm just using random numbers for this example. But I'll get a certain percentage of A kids, and I'm going to get a certain percentage of B's, a certain percentage of C's. That's how, if you're listening to this or as I'm talking to you guys, you know, think back to the last couple of years. What would it average out? Here's what we usually bring in, percent of A kids, percent of B kids, percent of C kids in a class. And what these really high-performing programs do is they'll figure out, okay, I know I'm going to bring in, let's just say, 40% or 50% B kids. Well, that's the biggest range. I mean, you think of the top of the B scale down to the bottom. That's usually the biggest number. That's the group of really solid or above average players, prospects. And so, the trend is, let's go for the A's and we'll settle for the B's. And what these high-performing programs tend to do is they will say, let's say 50% of my class is coming from the B's. I'm going to ask them first. I'm going to wrap up my B's first. And they'll go and they'll try to get the highest grouping of B's. Because if you imagine all 50% of your B's were up in that upper section of that range, of that scale that I'm asking you to imagine. Well, first of all, if you're a good player and you're an A, are you going to make your decision usually sooner or later? Do you have more options or less options?
You have more options.
You have more options. And so the tendency is, hey, coach, I'm interested, but I'm going to take these 2 more visits, or I'm going to play out this tournament, see what other coaches are interested. They just have options. And so they're going to usually take longer. The B kids don't have that luxury. They know they're on the bubble. They know that they're probably going to play somewhere, but they're not sure where, and it isn't guaranteed. And they know that there are kids that are better than them, but they are really wanting to play college volleyball or college basketball or whatever their sport. And so when you go and ask them first, surprise, they're actually ready to say yes because they don't want to mess around with this. It's far easier to get a commitment from a good, solid B kid than an A. So if I get 50% of high B's, and I do that early. Let's just say that's the first group. I got 50% of my class signed, and they're all in that upper B range, which some of those are going to turn into A's. Are you feeling pretty good now as far as like heading into the rest of the recruiting year? Yeah, darn right you are. And so now you can go into the A's, and you're not desperate, and you can actually play the long game with those other schools that you're competing with and win a lot of those A's. And listen, whoever's left, let's just say you get your A's, your normal 20% of A's, so you got 50% plus your 20%, and you still now have 30%. Well, there's still a bunch of B's that you can go out and get that are usually still available. So I'm going to get those B's, and then I'm done. And what great programs do, again, if you can imagine the scale, A at the top, B, and then C, and imagine the bottom of that scale rising up. Year after year, that rises up. The top doesn't move, but the bottom rises up. Guys, that's how we find the good programs build their teams. It's not that they get more A's. It's that the quality of the rest of their team, the bottom keeps coming up to where they don't really ever recruit a bad player. And I think there is, for a lot of teams, they're just resigning themselves to saying, well, we're gonna end up getting C's or some low B's. And if you keep waiting for the A's, and then they all disappear, and now you have to go after the B's, well, guess what? That top group of B's is gone, and now you're recruiting middle-level B's, low B's, and then into the C's. And now those are your players for the next 4 years. So that's, you know, one of the things we accidentally have discovered that, or some coaches have just figured it out. But that's one thing that I think separates some good programs from some not so good programs.
How important is it to identify, or to, I guess, to be able to know what an A is and a B is and a C is? And do you have advice for how recruiters can be better at that?
That is a complicated answer. There's an answer, but it's very, very complicated, and I would need like a whiteboard and another half hour of your time.
Okay.
But okay, so here's the thing. I'll sort of draw it out conceptually. And anybody listening to this, if we've done a workshop, they know what I'm going to describe. So it'll be easier for them if they're listening. But right now, I think people, you know, so we use loose terms like A's, B's, and C's. That's actually not my favorite way to grade a player, because everybody that's hosting this podcast could see an outside hitter as a volleyball coach and say, well, I like him. Yeah, I kind of like him. And then the third one, I don't really like him because of this. It doesn't fit into my system, or that's not what I want in an outside hitter. And so it's subjective. There's, you know, and then you bring it into your staff. Hey, coach, I saw this great kid at this tournament. We need to recruit him. Well, you know, tell me about him. Well, he's really good. He's got good footwork. And well, I need to go watch him because I don't – basically what you're saying is the coach, I don't believe you. I need to go see him for myself. And so then the head coach goes out. Hey, he was pretty good. Let's track him. And so then the assistant coach goes out again, and then the head coach. And you need to see him four or five times. I don't think you really do, but most coaches believe that, where if you had a grading system based on numbers, so if you had a ranking by skill set and you were to assign a number – per skill set that gave you a total number for that athlete. So let's just say they were a 50 out of a total 60 score. Now you can actually rank and rate athletes intelligently, as opposed to, you know, I think he's a gold star, I think he's a four, or a, you know, it. So there's a better way to do it. But that's actually, I mean, we approach an area then where for our organization, we draw a line. We never tell a coach, here's who you need, or here's how you should rank a player, because anybody that listens to me for volleyball recruiting or scouting advice on, you know, on the kids to get, or any other sport, basketball, baseball, you're going to lose because you're the experts in that. It's just that I want a staff to be able to move quickly through the process and know, here's our number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 guy in the, by these positions, so that you, or if we happen to be working with that coach, we can start at number one. Let's try to get number one. We'd hang at number one. Okay, let's get number two. Hey, got number two. That's great. Didn't get number three. Didn't get number four. We got number five. Okay, good. You needed two for that position. We're done. And we got them in numerical order, not based on who's showing the most interest, or he has a lot of heart, or I really like the way she, you know, whatever. It's based on talent, because at the end of the day, especially the higher levels that you get, of course, that's how you're measured. And I'm opposed to coaches getting fired, so I like for them to get the best players possible.
That was part one on recruiting with Dan Tudor. Join us next week for part two.